drums. These played very loudly beside me, breaking that spell. So the dream vanished, whereat I thanked heaven. I shed many tears before the thin moon rose up, frail and faint as a sickle of straw. Now, though the enchanter gnash his teeth vainly, yet shall he return as the spring returns. O wretched man, hell gapes, Erebus now lies open. The mouths of death wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Because I'm still out of sorts, and still waiting for my microphone thingy, this show number 36 is going to be another thing from an old exotic LP, but of a completely different character from the previous one. This is taken from an oral history of the Aerojet General Corporation, which talks a lot about the early bits of the space age in the United States, and is involved heavily with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, which is of course well known for lunar and planetary probes, but which started out as effectively the Rocket Club at Caltech, and Aerojet Corporation was another thing that developed out of that. That was sort of their experimental branch. Now, the unique and utterly ill-conceived feature of this recording is that it is narrated by a person who had a key role to play in the events, which doesn't seem unreasonable, until you realize that it's Dr. Theodor von Karman, famous, brilliant aerodynamicist, who speaks with an impenetrable, bulletproof Hungarian accent. They couldn't have done any worse if they'd got Dr. Chen Shui-Tsien to narrate it, except, of course, that Dr. Tsien was deported by the Eisenhower administration, who apparently thought that ballistic missiles were of no conceivable strategic importance. At least they thought that in the early 50s. By the late 50s, they had a rather different idea.
Here is the Executive Vice President of Aerojet General Corporation, Mr. William E. Zisch.
Thank you. Our look into the first 20 years in the life of Aerojet General Corporation must start with the company's heritage, the time before the beginning, around 1940, when a small group of rocket enthusiasts, whose names were Summerfield, Molina, Foreman, and Parsons, came together at Caltech to pursue their almost mystic vocation, rocketry. This group was united in purpose in the Gallsett Project No. 1 under the far-sighted leadership of Dr. Theodor von Karman.
I am very glad to have the occasion to talk to you about the time as the Aerojet General Corporation, or more exactly, at that time, the Aerojet Engineering Corporation was formed. Because, of course, this event is very near to my heart, and my experiences before and my experiences after that maybe have some interest as far the history of rocketry and the history of spaceflight in the United States is concerned. Now, as I started to organize that, it was really Hap Arnold, General Arnold, who was helpful. Now, what we started to do at Caltech, for which was a an immediate application. It was the assisted takeoff.
Assisted takeoff rockets, JATO rockets, were in fact developed and built in those early days at Caltech. Small though they were, they did work, as was proved in actual aircraft testing. Involved in that early manufacture was Fred Miller, and flight tests were performed by then Captain Homer Boucher.
But the aircoup flight tests were conducted with units made at Caltech, and a couple of these units are still on display in the plant here. They were 15 seconds duration and 25 pounds thrust.
Before initiating work on a larger size JATO rocket, it was considered necessary to verify theory by actual tests with aircraft. And since the size and thrust of the small rocket motors was quite modest, the smallest available airplane was selected for tests. Accordingly, an aircoup type airplane was fitted with racks under each wing to hold the solid propellant rockets, six on each side, giving a total JATO thrust of about 600 pounds. At March Field, we received every help, and the Cal-SIT group, as the Caltech group was known in those days, immediately began preparations for the tests at March Field.
Oh, they're real spectacular, quite spectacular in the takeoff, the angle of takeoff. But as soon as the units terminated, why, the plane would just quit climbing right there.
Work on JATO rockets, Gauss at Project Number 1, continued until 1942, when World War II brought about a requirement for JATO in quantity.
Now, then, in the beginning of the 40s, the war started, and the question came, who can do the production in first line of JATO? And at that time, I think it was Malina who came with to me and said that they believe, he and the other boys too, that for the production it would be the best to make an industrial company. This Aerojet Engineering Corporation was incorporated on March 20, 1942. I think the tremendous capital was $1,250. There were five with $250 each. And I was elected as president. The incorporation was made by Andrew G. Haley, whom I knew as lawyer.
Aerojet was formed. As the summer of 1942 passed, Dr. Van Karman became convinced that his administrative duties and the new company's sales effort were taking up valuable time which he felt was needed for technical guidance and research. It was then he decided to become board chairman and technical director of Aerojet and looked outside the company for a new president.
So I talked with my friends and asked them whether they agree if we ask Haley to be president. Well, they said yes. So Haley came, and I became then chairman of the board. This happened in September 23rd, 1942.
At about the same time, another group interested in rockets was forming under Navy contract at Annapolis. Most of these people subsequently became a part of Aerojet II. One of them was Bill House.
So I guess it was in June of 1942 that I went back to Annapolis and went to work with Bax, Ray Stiff, Bill Gore. And I remember Carman used to be a consultant around there at the time. Well, it was then Commander Bolster, who was head of ship installations, was running it, was the engineering experiment station, Project 3401.
As usual, people with common interests soon come together. The Navy at Annapolis, having more than a passing interest in our progress, sent Marine test pilot Bill Gore west.
And having contacted the Jet Propulsion Lab, GALSET project, at Caltech, at about the time that Aerojet Engineering Corporation was formed, Bill House and I came out to California in an SBD to test the first 8AS 200. These tests were so successful that later developments brought about the 5AS 1000, 10AS 1000, 12AS 1000, 14AS 1000, which was the one produced in great quantity as far as solid JATOs were concerned for the war.
During the war, our production was accomplished where formerly automobiles were doctored, and our testing was done in what really could have been called a gravel pit. Aerojet's people performed outstanding work in what were somewhat less than outstanding working quarters. They remember it well.
In those days, of course, we were located in Pasadena in the old Hudson building.
In what used to be the, what was actually the garage. We had the offices in the showroom. Then, you know, in the automobile agency, you have the showroom, then you go through a door into the garage, service garage. Set up the production line and built them. All the testing was done at Azusa. We had what we called, what Eddie Behan insisted on calling, the proving grounds.
When I entered the gate and got to my assigned place, I couldn't believe that that's really where we work, you see. It was very close to the test facility. It was a temporary shack.
I was taken on a tour to see this reputed proving grounds at Azusa. And I can truthfully say now that as I witnessed my first rocket firing, my reaction was one of incredulence that this couldn't possibly be, and I was not sure whether I should call back to Indianapolis directly or wait till that evening to advise my wife and two children, with a third one expected, to stay where they are, and I'd be back in the Midwest by the first train.
Toward the end of the third year of war, production was increasing and Aerojet became interested in additional projects. Capital and management assistance were needed. They were, in fact, provided by the General Tire and Rubber Company, personified by Mr. Kimball and Mr. Rood.
So General Tire and Rubber Company agreed to put in some additional money, and we purchased a 50% interest in the Aerojet Corporation.
Do you mean chairman of the board and director? Member of the board of director till 1944, October, 26th of October. This was the time when General Tires entered and bought from us the majority of the shares.
Went back to tell the people in Akron and General Tire what we're going to do. They asked if we could make any money, and we said, well, we didn't know whether we could make any money or not, but we hoped we wouldn't lose any.
And a short time afterwards, we purchased the facilities at the Azusa plant and moved our headquarters from the Pasadena Automobile Agency out to the Azusa plant.
Things progressed very well indeed until the war ended and the government sent us a telegram terminating all our contracts and putting us out of business.
At least we were out of business for about 2 days until many of the programs were reinstated.
And we went down to about 1,500 total employees between General Tire and Aerojet combined, down to about 350. And the government assured Mr. Kimball and Mr. Rood that they could foresee a requirement for more rockets, so they kept the doors open.
The company continued as a rocket and rocket propulsion company until 1947 saw some diversification with the creation of the Facilities Division under Ben Rose, which we know now as Atron.
But I think the first thing that we had a job to enter the space age building program. And to build a space age program, we called it then designing and building the experimental rocket engine test station at Muroc, California.
2 years later, management realized a need for high-level technical guidance and created a board specifically to serve this need.
It was changed somewhat in 1949. On January 17th was the first meeting of the Technical Advisory Board called TAP.
The next year, 1950, sales were up and work on current projects crowded every corner of our Azusa plant.
In a short while, we found out that our facilities at Azusa, due to the testing we were doing, and occasionally malfunctioned, either intentional or otherwise, causing explosions, detonations, so forth, made it a little difficult for us to continue some of this work at Azusa.
I think it was Ken Munt, since he came from Sacramento, that suggested looking at this site right here. It was far and away the best. We had the land, the water, the necessary isolation combined with the requisite accessibility, power. So we built what was known as the Sacramento Solid Rocket Plant.
I think one of the most permanent impressions that I ever have was the tremendous trouble that occurred when we tried to put the JATO, the present 15KS-1000, into production at Sacramento.
The 15KS-1000 JATO developed at Azusa simply wouldn't work when production moved north. Dr. Antonio went to Sacramento to help. Elmer Nelson, Bill Burdick, Freddie Miller, Charlie Large, Dick Geckler, and Ernie Roberts all worked tirelessly. Mr. Rood made daily checks on progress, and through it all, Mr. W. O'Neill patiently pointed out that he had encountered production problems in the tire business, and he knew we could solve our problems. Solve our problems we did, and the Sacramento Solid Rocket Plant was underway. Later, Aerojet General entered into an Air Force competition for the engines for the backup Atlas program, which later became the Titan program. To do this job, we needed to build additional facilities.
It was obvious at that time that we couldn't do it in Azusa, and Sacramento was the spot, and Mr. Rood, Mr. Kimball, Mr. Zisch authorized the acquisition of additional land, and we actually started building the first test stand, C test stand, before we had a contract, so we could say that we were underway. And that was in 1954. We received the contract award notice the first week in January 1955, and then we started to build what is now the liquid rocket plant.
Sacramento also has great pride in the work performed there on the Polaris program. While the Polaris, under the leadership of Vern Kirshner, was the key to Aerojet General's considerable competence in the large solid rocket field, it had its early problems, particularly in terms of personnel.
It was really a very serious problem to get a manpower pool together, which was estimated to be required for such a contract as the Polaris. We had two problems. One, to gather the most competent people within the company without hurting the other programs in being, and then to augment this perhaps tenfold in the first year and another tenfold in the next year. And that represents a tremendous dilution, of course.
From the beginning of our Sacramento plants to 1962 was the period that saw our company solidify and mature. Aerojet became active in diverse fields which saw the creation of our ordnance, aeronautical, space general, astronautics, oceanics, advanced research, torpedo, power equipment, Atlantic, Nerva, Astrochem, and nuclear divisions. Important changes have come to pass in terms of manufacturing, representation, sales, architecture, engineering, and the influence of the Technical Advisory Board. We turn to Mr. Munt and Mr. Rogers, Mr. Rose, and Dr. Van Carmen for some pertinent thoughts thereupon.
Right now, our best manufacturing plant is Downey and the liquid rocket plant at Sacramento.
In 1951, when I went to the Washington office for the company, the entire Aerojet General Corporation sales volume at that time was $40 million annually. And we had three men in the Washington office covering the entire Aerojet General Corporation Washington picture. I often think of that today when our Azusa plant has about twice that sales activity, and we have about the same number of men in the Washington office representing the Azusa plant alone, and yet the Azusa plant is a small fraction of the total sales and effort of the company today.
And speaking of other projects that we have worked on is the Space Age Museum for the state of California that is located in Exposition Park. We are interested in the commercial development or urban renewal. We have made some studies about mass transportation. We have made some studies about the possible growth of shopping centers. We have been following this avenue up in providing facilities for universities.
The Technical Advisory Board always insisted that we send people to school, send people to Los Alamos to observe the thing and follow up. Till I believe in the last year, the first larger contracts came in connection with the Rover project as the construction and building of the Nerva rocket.
The first 20 years haven't been all technical problems and management considerations. Who can ever forget Ernie Roberts, framed by a blown-out window, the latest thing in starched collars? Or our top executives, including Andy Haley, then president, and Eddie Behan, then general manager, in gloves and coveralls, cleaning, loading, painting, and shipping the early JATOs on an all-night swing shift that lasted for weeks. Some of the early conversations the military had with us and a General Tire board meeting were really very amusing. No doubt about it, a sense of humor has been an important ingredient of our success.
But as we started with the first contract, which was $10,000, I believe, where I could employ and pay this boy for the work, General Shidlaw, who is now a retired general with four stars, and I think president or vice president of Thomson's product, looked at me and said, "Doctor, you really believe that the Air Force shall spend as much as $10,000 for rockets?"
To most of us that have been connected with Aerojet, rockets has been the most important thing in the world. A demonstration of how this point of view can grow on you was exhibited during the first meeting of the board of directors of the General Tire and Rubber Company in Azusa. Dan Kimball had encouraged W. O'Neill to come out here with the board for a regular meeting and at the same time to allow the board to have a first-hand look at this Hill Rocket Company that they had taken under their wing back in 1944. After their regular morning meeting, they had lunch, and then Dan was going to bring them down to the proving grounds where we had arranged a display of hardware that we were working on that we felt might better tell the story of what we were trying to do. The first display they were going to see was the Bomark missile. Although we were only developing the booster rocket for this missile, it was the largest item we were working on, and we had for display a complete Bomark missile with the rocket attached on a carrier that was used for hauling the missile in the field. I was positive that this would be most impressive to the board. I was sure that it would be they would be closer to a missile than any of them, most of them had ever been before, and that they would that Aerojet would gain a new respect in their eyes for working on such a significant and impressive item. As they came down from the cafeteria and approached the rocket, the missile on a carrier, I watched them closely, and to a man, every one of their eyes dropped to the tires that were on this carrier. And I, for the first time, looked at those tires, and unfortunately, they were not general tires. The only way they came back to listen to anything we had to say was to introduce them to the item by starting out with the saying that, gentlemen, this carrier is not supplied by Aerojet. It has been supplied to us by the prime contractor, and we're making arrangements to change the tires in the morning. After that, they were with me just a little bit. Point of view is really important.
Certain contracts have been significant in the growth of our company. We asked Dr. Roberts, Mr. Ross, and Mr. Kimball to exercise their point of view on the subject.
First, the JATO contract, and second, I think the Polaris contract. Very soon, we had, of course, the Minuteman contract, which in significance is great.
As I recall, around 1946, there was a sudden requirement for the B-29 to carry, I believe, 150,000, somewhere around 148, 150,000 gross payload. So it appeared that the only answer was to build a small pressurized unit of some 4,000 pounds thrust, as I recall, for of which then the B-29 was to use two of these, and they were attached between the engine nacelles. And although the requirement for the for the use of it disappeared after a couple of years, it was actually judged to be probably the first really operational liquid engine. From there, we went into competition with the then and probably still significant people in the liquid engine business for the development of the acid gasoline assist takeoff units for the B-47. And then the same engine series worked into the F-84 assist takeoff, and a fourth unit was the in-flight thrust augmentation unit for the F-86, which also was very successfully flight tested. The group that I mentioned stayed with this program, and of course they were the key people that put together and won the competition in the early or the middle 50s for the Titan engine, which is now quite a significant effort at Aerojet.
Of course, I'm sure that the first contract we got was the production contract on the old asphalt JATO. In addition to that contract, and that's the one we remember, of course, the contracts that we've gotten in later years have been great pride to all of us, our Polaris, our Minuteman, our Titan, and lately our Rover contract and our contract for the M1, which is a 1,200,000-pound liquid hydrogen engine.
Time magazine has called Aerojet the General Motors of U.S. rocketry. And CBS says that Aerojet is the fabulous success story of our time. While these glowing portrayals may be somewhat over-exuberant, it is fact that our company has enjoyed an unequaled growth record during the first 20 years. We're often asked why Aerojet General Corporation has grown from the little Pasadena garage operation into a company which is indeed large by any standard. The reasons why are as diverse as the company.
I think it's a combination of many things. First, of course, the times we live in.
Dynamic management leadership, Mr. Kimball, Mr. Rood, and Mr. Zisch, almost from the outset, at least from 1944 on. And we had the heritage and wisdom of Dr. von Karman backing us.
I must say that on the other hand, that the General Tires was always willing to go with money, with capital, in project, but we, from the technical point of view, judged as promising, and I believe that the cooperation was very pleasant and very nice.
I believe that the most significant things about Aerojet are, one, its technical competence in the fields which it is interested, and two, that the employees, whether they be technical or otherwise, find a management atmosphere under which they can work, second to none in any company in the United States.
We were very fortunate in the fact that we were part of the General Tire and Rubber Company because they didn't think we were ever going to do any good, so they didn't ask us to prefer any profit on it. In the last 18 years, since 1944, we've all the money we've made, we've put back into, we haven't paid our stockholders any dividends, we've put it back into building up the size of the company. We have an esprit de corps, I think, is unmatched in our industry or almost any other industry. More than making money, we've performed, had technical breakthroughs that are been unmatched in any place in the world on the things we've done. The greatest contribution to the success of our company is in the technical competence and the spirit of all the people that have worked with the company. I think we've enjoyed our growth chiefly because we've taken hard jobs and we've done them well. We haven't taken any jobs that we didn't think we could do. We've walked away from some work we didn't think was possible of accomplishment at that time.
Certainly everybody at Aerojet was in there pitching. Stanford Research Institute issued a study recently on what makes a growth company, and it looks like they came to talk to Aerojet.
Aerojet today is the acknowledged leader in many highly technical fields. For a glimpse of a very bright future, we turn again to our leaders.
I feel that the Aerojet General Corporation will continue to grow, and really, 10 years from now, will be a much larger, possibly somewhat diversified, but certainly headquarters or our branches or our plants will be scattered in a great many spots in addition to the state of California.
I believe that the space flight and in connection with that rocketry first has for several years or decades a great importance for military purpose. Even if we don't want to make war, and we really don't, you must do this to be sure that nobody else does it. Immediate applications I see are the following. First, the weather satellites. Weather control is possible, then I think that the communication, I mean television and telephone, ordinary telephone, can be improved very much by introduction of a satellite system.
As to where we're going to go from here, how do we know? In 1946, we were hoping we could get up to $4 or $5 million a year. Our sales in the last 5 years have come up from something like $100 million to almost $500 million. Our sales in 10 years from now, we don't know. I think the important thing is not how big our sales are going to be, but about how good we're going to do in the jobs that we're doing. We hope that our plants can go down in size if we can get peace in the world. But until we can get peace in the world, our company is going to keep on growing, growing in technical competence, and the size will take care of itself. We haven't any ambitions to be the biggest company in the world. We just want to be the best company in the world in management, in technical competence, and the other things that we can do to make contributions to the welfare of the United States.
Aerojet General Corporation, 1962, past, present, and future. Only one small item of business remains. Dr. Antonio, highly competent chemist, engineer and administrator, and genuine good friend, was asked, "What does the term Aerojet General Corporation mean to you?" In his answer, he seemed to express the feelings of us all.
Apart from its being a high-principled company, a company that very seriously accepts the responsibilities that the Defense Department and the Space Agency, the government as a whole, places upon us, Aerojet means to me a somewhat unorthodox but very nimble company that has the capability to marshal its forces at critical times and to come through when the infighting is really rough. This to me is the real guts of the organization, and I pray to God that we keep it for a long time to come.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/Publius_reads. Thank you.
That was Federico Mompau. Next is William Stone III with Restone B Anonspot Zero.
Hello, I'm one of the text-to-speech voices you'll occasionally hear on Tales from SYL Ranch. Tales from SYL Ranch is live Sundays from 2000 to 2200 UTC. The show is an eclectic mix, with each one having a theme. One week might be Maestro John Williams, and the next could be Rocky Horror. Interspersed libertarian and tech rants. Listen to Tales from SYL Ranch on anonradio.net Sundays from 2000 to 2200 UTC. If you don't, I'm going to start drowning kittens in a bucket of water.
What? No, we're not going to drown kittens.
Yes, I am. I have a bucket right here. It'll do it.
No, you're not going to drown kittens. Listen to Tales from SYL Ranch on anonradio.net Sundays from 2000 to 2200 UTC.
For the sake of the kittens.
You're not going to drown kittens.
Yes, I am. Don't think for a moment that I won't.
Oh, really? Why pretend? We both know perfectly well what this is about. You want me to have an abortion?
It's really the only sensible thing to do. If it's done safely, therapeutically, there's no danger involved.
That was Andres Segovia. Next is Federico Mompou with Mompou, Fights Loincains, number 2. That was Federico Mompou. Next is Federico Mompou with Mompou, Impressions Intimas, number 9. That was Federico Mompou. Next is Carlo Pezzamenti with Song of the Fisherman. Thank you.
call the SDF Public Access Unix System at
436-3281.
This is a four-line system, Corey. It is the SDF, and I am the system administrator.
Uh-uh, I'm the system administrator. You're just a rude.
That was Andres Segovia. Next is Andres Segovia with Saw, 12 Etudes, Opus 6, Number 8 in C.
Thank you.
That was Andrei Segovia. Next is Kammerorchester Berlin. Helmut Koch with Brandon Bajaj's Concert No. 2, 3, Satz Allegro SA.
It's 16 hours.
CQ, CQ, CQ.